Hello and welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Today I'm welcoming onto the show the ultimate feminist, Mona Eltahawy. She has written a manifesto as in a book form, and it's called The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls. She's a journalist and she's talking to us from New York today. And hello, a massive warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, Josephine. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Just to let you know, you'll only hear female voices on Radio Gorgeous. But you're very welcome. So before we get going, I'd like to tell us a definition of the word patriarchy, because that word is used a lot in the book.
So patriarchy in a textbook form is systems of oppression that privilege male dominance. But in Mona's form, I want people to imagine an octopus. And the head of the octopus is patriarchy, and each one of the eight tentacles of the octopus is one of those oppressions that privileges male dominance. So one of them is white supremacy or racism, one of them is capitalism, one of them is misogyny, one is homophobia, one is transphobia, one is ableism, one is ageism. So basically all the isms that are used against us. And imagine that octopus squeezing us between the tentacles. Now, obviously, a Black woman, a trans woman, an older woman, or a woman who lives in especially impoverished conditions, depending on where you live and how you live, you're going to be squeezed between one or more of the tentacles. But patriarchy is that octopus, and it is, I have vowed to destroy that octopus that I call patriarchy.
Fantastic. So now we know we're up against this very, very giant octopus. Can you tell us, before we delve into your book, you're an Egyptian by birth, who was brought up in Glasgow, Scotland, and Saudi Arabia. Sounds terribly complicated.
Well, so my family moved to London. First, we were in London before Glasgow, because both my parents are medical doctors. They met in medical school, and they both got scholarships to study for their PhDs in London, which is why we moved to London when I was seven. And my accent used to be much more of a South London accent in it when I was younger. So we moved to London when I was seven, and then Glasgow when I was 13. And then when I was 15, we moved to Saudi Arabia, where my parents both got jobs. So I've grown up between Egypt, the UK, and Saudi Arabia. And then I moved back to Egypt in my early 20s to study journalism and start my career in journalism.
But the thing was that you'd already had exposure to Western culture because of living in art, in Britain. So tell us just the shock of moving to Saudi Arabia at a very, very vulnerable age, 15.
Well, Saudi Arabia is very different than Egypt. And I think one of the things that I also pointed out in my first book, Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution, is that that part of the world that I'm from is very different. It's not monolithic. So Egypt is a Muslim majority country, as is Saudi Arabia. But the way that religion plays out and the way that the culture plays out in those two countries is very different. So I was born in Egypt and, like I said, moved to the UK when I was seven. But I'll tell you, before we moved to Saudi Arabia, even though, it was a Western environment, so many of my teachers, who were mostly white English women, kept asking me what my dad did, as if my mom did nothing except follow this man around the world. So from a very young age, I got an early lesson that there was such little expectation of what a Muslim woman could do. And I would proudly tell my teachers that my mother and my father are the reason that we moved to London, because both my mother and my father are studying for their PhDs. So I grew up, being very proud of both my parents. And I had this incredible role model in my mother, who was living a feminist life as, a doctor studying for her PhD alongside her husband. And for our last year in the UK, my mum was the breadwinner because my dad couldn't find a job, because it was the beginning of the recession during Thatcher UK. So my mum was supporting our family. And then we had to leave because my dad couldn't find a job. And according to visa regulations, the father is the head of the household and the children get their residency through him. So, that wasn't very feminist of Mrs. Thatcher and her government. And we left. Well, I never believed Thatcher was a feminist, but
no,
anyway.
It wasn't, no.
So yeah. That was another example. So yeah. We moved to Saudi from Glasgow, and that was a real reverse culture shock for me, because like I said, Saudi Arabia is nothing like Egypt. It's a much more conservative country. And the way religion plays out there is a much more conservative and authoritarian version of the religion. So here's my mother now, the woman with a PhD, the woman who is a doctor, who was my first feminist role model, unable to drive, because at the time women couldn't drive, and we were all dependent on my father, in a way that my English teachers assumed, but we actually weren't, until we moved to Saudi Arabia. But she was teaching medical students, she was still a doctor, but the outside kind of trappings of it all were very conservative.
And did she have to, did you all have to cover up there?
Well, my mother chose to wear hijab when we first went on pilgrimage, and that's the fifth pillar of Islam. So she did very soon after we moved. And then I chose to wear the headscarf a year after. Now, in Saudi Arabia, you do have to when you go out, but it's something that my mum and I both chose. But then I chose to take it off. I say it took me 8 years to choose to take it off, and that kind of, you know, and that's kind of the muddle, to muddle the word choice. But my mother to this day still wears a headscarf, and as does my sister. So I offer my family in the first book as an example of three very different women whose approach to religion and veiling are very different, just to remind people that we're not monolithic.
Yes. Because that's another thing, people will put you just in one bracket, don't they? You know, when they hear, as you say, remember in the book, you say, I'm a woman of color, I'm a, you know, a Muslim, all these things, people imagine you to be somebody, you know, and then they meet you and you're the most colorful, outrageous, say what you think, brilliant character. Now, okay, so please, can you tell us about the seven necessary deadly sins for women and girls? Can I ask why the word necessary has to be in it?
Well, I because, you know, I'm riffing off the seven deadly sins, you know, the Christian seven deadly sins. And my book is about the seven necessary sins. And I call them necessary sins because these are, quote unquote, sins that patriarchy doesn't want women to live or to have or to do. And I say that they're necessary because I believe that we need them. We need to arm ourselves with them in order to slay that octopus that I call patriarchy. Because each one of the sins helps us cut off those tentacles, the eight tentacles of the octopus that I call patriarchy.
Fantastic. So can you tell us what was your first moment you decided to write the book? You know what I mean? The cutting point.
Well, ultimately, the inspiration for my book was that I'm finding feminism increasingly too polite. And this is a book that is the antithesis of polite. And I'm finding feminism, especially that is written mostly by white women, liberal women, neoliberal women. And these are, you know, and I'm happy to go into those definitions later. I find the feminist books that have been coming out by women of those backgrounds to be accommodational to patriarchy, too polite to patriarchy. And I call them roadmaps on the path to peace to patriarchy. And I don't want to make peace with patriarchy. I want to destroy patriarchy. So I wrote this book as a manifesto that I describe. I liken it to a Molotov cocktail that I want people to throw into the belly of that octopus I call patriarchy. Because I'm not interested in making peace with patriarchy, and I'm not interested in teaching women and girls how to survive patriarchy. Of course, every day we have to survive patriarchy. I'm interested in arming women and girls with things that will help them to destroy patriarchy. So my manifesto is a manifesto that is the antithesis of polite and please, and I'm nice, and please give me some crumbs from your cake. I'm like, I don't want your cake. I don't want your crumbs. I want my own cake. And I'm making that cake through these seven necessary sins.
Fantastic. I love it. So, okay, let's start with the number one, which is anger.
So I began, I've ordered the sins deliberately. And the first, and kind of like the junior sin, if you like, is anger. And the reason that I put it at the beginning and I continue with the others is that many of those, you know, what I call polite books on feminism that have come out recently, act as if anger is the end all be all, in that you just have to be angry and that's it. And that's not enough. And that chapter was inspired, actually quite a large part of the book all of it was inspired by living under the Trump regime. You know, I call it the Trump regime, because a lot of white American women, and I'm an Egyptian American, a lot of white American women only began to get angry at Donald Trump when that tape came out where he said, when your famous women allow you to grab them by the pussy, by the genitals. And the rest of us were angry at Donald Trump way before that, when he was making racist statements against Mexicans, making Islamophobic statements against Muslims, and generally being a racist.
Yeah.
So I wrote that book to say, yes, anger is very important. And it's important to remember that It's what patriarchy uses to control us, because it teaches us that we will give you some crumbs if you're polite and quiet about it. And I want us to be the opposite of quiet and polite. And I remind people that we're all born with anger. I call it the pilot light that every girl has, because it's the correct behavior to be angry at injustice. But there's much more to do other than just being angry.
Fantastic. Okay. So attention. Just to let you know, but throughout my life, I've been called an attention seeker, which I haven't minded at all.
Excellent. See, I just wrote an essay last week on my newsletter, Feminist Giant. I wrote an essay on that, you know, I called a vindication of the demands of attention whores. You know, I'm playing on the vindication on the rights of women by Mary Wollstonecraft, of course. So I've also been called an attention seeker so many times. When I got arrested for spray painting over a racist ad in the New York subway, I was accused of doing it for attention. When I had my arms broken and I was sexually assaulted by Egyptian riot police during our year of revolution, I was accused of throwing myself at the police because I wanted to be on TV and get attention. It's ridiculous. So I wrote that chapter and I chose attention as a sin because it's obvious that that's the way patriarchy controls those of us who dare to say, my ideas are important, I'm important. And kind of like the leitmotif of so much of what I write is my belief that the most subversive thing a woman can do is to talk about her life as if it really matters, because it does. So we deserve attention. Our ideas deserve attention. We are important and we deserve attention. That's in.
That's fantastic. Right. I keep on saying fantastic, I think. Okay. The next one is fucking hell. It's profanity, isn't it, love?
I'm so glad you're swearing because I never know what the
policies you can swear to, your heart's content on this one.
I love it.
Be yourself, love.
Josephine, my, you know, when I introduce myself, you know, whenever I appear on shows or in lectures and stuff, you know, other than the big networks that of course would beep it all out, I say, my name is Mona Al-Tahawi, my pronouns are she, her, hers, and this is my declaration of faith, fuck the patriarchy. That's my manifesto. And that's what drives that chapter. Because, you know, again, during the Trump regime, racists, white supremacists would often try to shut us up by saying, oh, civility, civility. No, 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 you have to be polite. And remember, there was Representative Rashida Tlaib, when she was elected to Congress, she had a private party where she said, impeach the motherfucker. And everyone just went nuts. So I'm a very, very proud, very profane feminist. And I spend about half of the chapter talking about an incredible feminist from Uganda called Dr. Stella Nyanzi, who was actually imprisoned in Uganda by the dictator of Uganda for swearing, for being rude, for being profane. So I say, you know, fuck the patriarchy, unleash with the language, fuck racism, fuck misogyny, because there is, I say, I will never be polite and I'll never be civil to anyone or anything that does not acknowledge my full humanity. And patriarchy, that fucking octopus, definitely does not acknowledge my full humanity. So fuck that shit.
Now, this is an interesting one. Ambition.
You know, the ambition chapter was the hardest chapter for me to write because I really want, what I wanted to do with this book too was take what we've been told are feminist successes and really shake them and look them in the eye and ask, for whom is this a success, you know? So with ambition, I wanted to have to really wrestle with that idea of, you know, lean in feminism and you should aspire to be the CEO and your ambition should be to become a millionaire. And I'm like, no, my ambition is not to become a millionaire. My ambition is to be free. And freedom is through destroying the patriarchy. Because so I wanted to know, you know, what is ambition for a working class woman? What is ambition for a woman who leaves her country to be a migrant domestic worker thousands of miles away to raise the children of other people while her family back home are raising her children? What's ambition for her? So I wanted to make it very clear also that I'm an anarchist feminist for whom wealth and the accumulation of wealth does not interest me. So what is my ambition? My ambition is to destroy patriarchy. And that lean-in brand of feminism that is, you know, acquire wealth and acquire corporate success often portrays to us success as, look, I've made it. And I wanted to remind people that feminism isn't me and a bunch of my mates making it because we managed through our privilege to jump over obstacles. For me, feminism is to destroy the obstacles and to allow all of us to go past those obstacles. So that's the chapter on ambition.
Yeah, because I think the ambition that the kind of people want us to have is to become one of the men. And that's the last thing we want to do, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, I tell people, feminism for me is not equality with men. Feminism is destroying patriarchy. And the reason that I say I want something much bigger than equality with men, many men themselves are not free. They're not free of capitalism. They're not free of racism. They're not free of so much that octopus also strangles them. But I don't give a fuck about men. I care about us. So my ambition is to be something much bigger than a man, much bigger than equality. My ambition is to be free.
I love it. Okay. Power.
Yes. Now, see, with power also, I wanted to take that and shake it. Because so often, we were talking about how Thatcher wasn't a feminist, right? Because again, we're portrayed, we're told, you know what? The way that you can become a powerful woman is, again, to be an imitation man. So we will allow a few women, this is patriarchy now, we will allow a few women into positions of power, and that's it. But then I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to support a woman just because she's a woman. I support women who dismantle patriarchy, not women who uphold patriarchy. And Thatcher upheld patriarchy. She destroyed unions, which did not help working class women or working class anyone. She was one of a very few women who made it. So she was one of those women that represent, I made it, therefore feminism has achieved all its goals. No. So for me, with power, I wanted to see what power really is. And power for me is to destroy that octopus, is to say it's condescending and patronizing to demand that I support a woman just because she's a woman. I want much more than that. I support a woman who looks patriarchy in the eye and says, I'm going to fucking destroy you. That's power for me.
Okay, right. And lust.
Oh, wait, there's violence. Violence is before.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's me being untogether. It's lucky that you're organized.
Oh, I'm here. You know, the violence chapter, Josephine, is the most controversial because it really upsets people. And look, before I talk about violence and why I wrote this chapter, I want to make clear that I want us to survive. And every day, patriarchy does its damnedest to make sure we don't survive. Hospitals, prisons, and cemeteries are full of women who fought back against patriarchy. And the streets of every country across the world are full of free men who put women in hospitals, prisons, and underground in cemeteries and face no consequences whatsoever. So I totally acknowledge that. And I'm not victim blaming, and I'm not putting the pressure on women here, because there are many moments in my life when I have not been able to fight back. And I write about them honestly. But here's the thing. I want patriarchy to fear us. Feminism must terrify patriarchy. And that's why I said one of the inspirations for my book was that feminism is too polite. I want us to terrify patriarchy. And I mentioned in that, in my chapter on violence. So ultimately the question that goes through that book is, how many rapists must we kill before men stop raping us? And I don't mean the death penalty, because I don't believe in the death penalty. And I don't mean the state, because I'm an anarchist. So I don't want the state and its monopoly on power to basically become the arbiter, because the state itself is violent against me. I'm talking about us, those of us who are hurt by patriarchy. And I quote substantially a professor of law who mentions, you know, in her article on this, and for a professor of law to say that women need to practice more justifiable violence against men's unjustifiable violence, that's a big deal. And she asks us to consider this. When a man is walking down the street, he thinks twice before picking a fight with another man, because he thinks, you know what? He can probably take me on. But men never think twice before they hit or beat or rape or murder women. And we're seeing this now under this fucking pandemic, where during a pandemic, when women are basically imprisoned at home with their terrorist, their abuser, there has been a 30% at least spike in intimate partner terrorism. I call it terrorism, not just violence. Those men who are beating women, who are under lockdown and quarantine with them, they never stop to think, she might poison my food. She's in the kitchen all day cooking for me. They never stop to think, she's in the kitchen with all these sharp instruments. She could just kill me, because they know that if she does, hospitals, prisons, and cemeteries are full of women who fought back.
Yeah, so I'm always shocked that women are so scared of walking the streets at night. It's never bothered me. And then you think, well, 99% of people that are murdered by someone they know, and it's more likely to be their boyfriend, you know. So
home is such a dangerous place for us.
Yeah, Yeah. And just to say that I've been a victim in the home and my daughter has been a victim in the home as well. So you're talking to someone that it's happened to.
Okay. I'm enraged to hear that. And I send you both love and solidarity.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So we're now on lust, which, I mean, again, if a woman, and you do say this, and I've always thought this, if a woman is a sexually active and is very proud about it and out about it, people say, what a slut. Whereas a man, it'd be like, he's a stud, you know.
And that's exactly.
That's always annoyed me.
You know, it's the same double standard that's at work with attention. And that's why in the chapter on attention, I say that attention and sex are put very close together by patriarchy. Because if we want them both, we're accused of being whores. So I say openly, you know what? I am a whore. There, I am a whore. I am a slut. Now what? So that chapter on lust is to take control of that and to say, I own my body. The heart of the sexual revolution is the declaration, I own my body. And that's where all the power comes from, consent and agency. It is my right to have sex with whomever, with their consent, obviously, whenever, with men, with women, with one, with three, with whatever I want. And for me, that I think is one of the biggest ways to challenge patriarchy and it's those tentacles because, and especially, and I identify as queer and polyamorous. So especially when you shake patriarchy up with all of those things to challenge heteropatriarchy, to challenge mononormativity, as we call it now, to say, I will not be monogamous. I will not be heteronormative. That for me is such a revolutionary challenge to patriarchy. And that's why I put lust at the end, because that will be the subject of my next book.
You also say again and again, I own my body, which is a very, strong, positive, you know, no one else does. No one else can take advantage. In fact, will you tell the story about you in the nightclub, please?
Yeah. Well, the story of me in the nightclub is great for anger and violence and so much of what the book represents. So it was in 2018, I was at a nightclub with my beloved in Montreal, Canada. And we were dancing and I love to dance. And when people ask me, how do you take care of yourself? I tell them by dancing. And I felt a hand on my bum and I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I was like, so I was 50 years old. So and I actually I start the book with this anecdote because I started by saying that when I was 15 years old, 15, during pilgrimage, which is, you know, the fifth pillar of Islam, I was sexually assaulted twice. I was covered from head to toe, only my face and my hands were showing. And I was sexually assaulted twice. And I was so horrified. I burst into tears. Took me years to even say what happened to me. But then fast forward to when I was 50, 50 now, and I had just started a movement, #MosqueMeToo, inspired by Tarana Burke and Me Too, to basically say, to tell other women of Muslim descent, this happened to me. And, you know, I want to encourage and inspire others to speak out. And I was so overwhelmed by the stories they sent me. I went out dancing 5 days after I started this viral hashtag.
You went out because of stress, bust your stress.
Exactly. Yeah. I went out to take care of myself after all these stories of harrowing sexual violence. And then I'm subjected again to sexual assault. This time around, I'm in a tank top and jeans. And I'm like, and I'm 50 years old. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Does this ever finish? So this time around, I was not that 15-year-old girl who was overwhelmed. And that's a perfectly normal reaction, who froze, perfectly normal reaction. Yeah. This time around, because I had been practicing all those sins, you know, throughout my life, I was ready for that piece of shit. I tracked him down and I tugged at his shirt. And he, of course, he was surprised because he didn't expect a woman to fight back. And this is why I say we have to fight back when we can. And I could. So I tugged at his shirt from behind. He fell and I sat on him, Josephine, and I punched and I punched and I punched. And every time I stopped, every time I thought, okay, that's enough, I was like, no, I'm not done. And every time I punched him, I told him, don't you ever fucking touch a woman like that again. And then I stopped and he stood up and he wanted to look at me because he wanted to see who's this woman who just beat the fuck out of me. And I smacked him across the door, almost broke my fingers. And he knew I was going to start punching him again and he ran away. And I started this hashtag I beat my assaulter, you know, again, and I was sent so many stories. But, you know, after I did that, my beloved and I went to get a glass of water and the club manager, and this is very telling, the club manager came up to me and asked me what happened. And I explained, and he actually had the nerve to say to me, why didn't you let your husband take care of it? And I almost beat him up. I said to him, first of all, he's not my husband. And second of all, this is my body and I take care of it. But this is a reminder that patriarchy enables and gives men the right to assault us, and then only gives the men who it thinks own us to fight back. And I was like, fuck this and fuck that. I'm fighting back.
Did they ask you to leave the club? You know what I mean? They might have thought of you as an aggressive, scary, mad woman. You know, that
which usually happens. Exactly. Yeah. No, in this instance, they didn't. In this instance, he just kind of, he was like, he looked at me as if I'd spoken to him in Martian or something, you know, and just shrugged and walked away. And I was like,
I tell you, that's what annoys me most, is that this label that, you know, women, you know, hysterical, mad, you know, that's been going on for centuries. I mean, why do men just throw that label at us?
To control us, because they want to shame us into not fighting back, into not shouting back, into not be basically saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore. So for those of us who do fight back and yell and punch and fight, they use those words to make us look, quote unquote, crazy. And to put off, it's a warning to other women and girls, don't behave like this. And if you don't behave like this, we will reward you with crumbs. But I don't want your fucking crumbs. I'm going to have my own cake. And that's exactly why I wrote The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls.
It is so empowering. It is so brilliant. And I think you are a brave, brilliant, so intelligent woman to think so amazingly differently. Also, I want to ask, because there are so many incredible women in the book, very, very moving stories. In fact, incredibly, just I can't even go there because they're so upsetting, some of them. Can you just tell me one person who personally has touched you most in the book?
Yeah, one of the things that I try to do in all of my books is to give people names of incredible, I call them women freedom fighters, and they're freedom fighters against the patriarchy, you know? And one of them is special because I want people to go and read about these incredible feminists. And I want people to remember that feminism is global. Patriarchy is global, but so is feminism. And so is feminist resistance to patriarchy. Because, you know, we're not just sitting there taking it. We're fighting back at great risk. And one of my feminist heroes, I call her, is Dr. Sera Nyanzi, this Ugandan feminist who I devote so much of the profanity chapter to. She now lives in Kenya. And she's asked for asylum because her life is threatened because of her feminist resistance to patriarchy in Uganda. Now, she is an academic. She fights for the rights of the LGBTQ community. She's been imprisoned several times by the Ugandan regime because she uses profanity proudly. She's a poet. And I love everything she represents. And she comes from a proud tradition of what one academic has called radical rudeness in Uganda. And it has its roots in the anti-colonial days when Britain occupied Uganda. And there were, you know, freedom fighters against colonization at the time refused to be polite in the way that British occupiers at the time insisted. Now, can you imagine being an occupier of a country who insists that the people who are fighting for their liberation from you be polite? It's the same as patriarchy insisting we're being polite. So they were like, fuck you. So that radical rudeness is a tradition that Sera Nyanzi continues and that I proudly write about in The Seven.
And also she's an inspiration to you, really, isn't she?
She really is. Yeah. So she's passed on that baton of how powerful profanity is to me.
Now, just one question about living in New York. Is it as liberal and feminist as it likes us to believe, New York City?
You know, nowhere in the world is completely feminist, and patriarchy lives everywhere in the world. So it depends on where in New York City you're talking about. And it depends, you know, that octopus that I describe patriarchy as, because the New York City, what I love about New York City is that it's a city that brings people from all over the world. So I feel utterly at home there. And there are people from all over the world. I think more than 700 languages are spoken in New York City. So that really speaks to how cosmopolitan it is. But you know, talk to Black women, talk to Latinx women, talk to disabled women, talk to queer women, talk to trans women, talk to all those women who are stuck in that octopus called patriarchy, and they will tell you that, yes, there is feminism in New York City, but there is also an incredible fight that we must undertake against the octopus, because the octopus lives in New York City as well. Now, compared to other cities in the United States, of course, New York is more progressive. I compare it to some cities in the South. Yeah. I compare it to other cities that are, you know, Trump supporting cities, absolutely, because it's all very relative, you know? But at the end of the day, I want people to always remember that the feminist fight must continue wherever we live.
Fantastic. So, what direct action would you like us to do after reading The Seven Necessary Deadly Sins for Women and Girls?
So it's just the seven necessary sins, no deadly in it. The deadly belongs to Christianity. There's no deadly for me.
Unconsciously, yeah. But deadly. I think dead is one of the things you want us to do, isn't it?
I want us to kill patriarchy, but I want us to survive. So I'm leaving the deadly sins to the Christians. I'm not Christian. I'm a feminist who wants us to do necessary sins.
All right. Okay. Brilliant.
So what, you know, when young women especially ask me, you know, how can I do all of this? First of all, I remind them, I did not come out of my mother's womb yelling, fuck the patriarchy. It took me years and years of, you know, feminist practice. So I like to describe the direct action I want people to undertake through what I call feminism in 3D. And the 3Ds are defy, disobey, and disrupt. So I want people to find ways every day to defy, disrupt, or disobey the patriarchy. And they can be as small, even though this is not small, as you hear someone making a misogynist joke or a statement, disrupt it. Someone at work, wherever you are at work right now because of this fucking pandemic, enacts something that is really misogynist or homophobic or transphobic, defy it, disobey it, you know, find a way that, and I often say as well that when we practice feminism in 3D, defy, disobey, disrupt the patriarchy, I want people to imagine that you're lifting weights, you know, at the gym or whatever, you know, you start with small weights and then your muscles get stronger and then you go on to bigger weights and heavier weights and heavier weights. That's exactly what feminism in 3D does. It is like practice. It's feminist practice that helps your feminist muscles become more and more powerful. So imagine you're doing all the, like, you know, your bicep, tricep things, and that's what you're doing through defying, disobeying, and disrupting the patriarchy.
So thank you so much, Mona, for disrupting us on Radio Gorgeous. And the 7 necessary sins for women and girls is out now and published by Tramp Press. Thank you so much. You've been...
Thank you.
Your eloquence and bravery is beyond anything I've ever known in my life. I worship you.
Josephine, that's very kind of you. Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I'm so glad we got to put in all those fucks and shits in there. And I'm delighted that it's called Radio Gorgeous because you and I are both looking gorgeous in our eyeliner and makeup and blush and all of that.
Yeah, we don't give a shit. Great. Totally. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Josephine.